This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, July 28th, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. Amazon Prime, Prime Day, plowing all those profits back into the company, the acquisition of Whole Foods, TV production and the resulting Emmy Awards, and of course, revolutionizing publishing. Is it time to call Amazon a monopoly? Cato Senior Fellow Walter Olson considers the question. There have been a lot of think pieces, I guess you would call them, about Amazon and its growth, especially in light of its recent acquisition of Whole Foods, that Amazon constitutes a monopoly. So as a matter of economics and law, and I understand that these are two different things when we're talking about what a monopoly is, what constitutes a monopoly?
I don't think anyone has a really good definition, and especially not in an area like this in which the technological state of the market, the transformation brought by new technologies, both of communication and of delivery, have so transformed the markets that Amazon operates in. A few years ago, it was clear that some commerce was moving online. It was not so clear that there would be powerful network benefits, as Amazon discovered, especially when it launched Amazon Prime and other loyalty programs based on benefits like free shipping. Competitors like Walmart.com are still important, but this is a relatively new situation. Not that Amazon has not been growing, not that it has not been sinking its revenues into improving its network rather than paying large dividends and that sort of thing. But the success of a few of the stratagems has gotten everyone's attention and has suggested that for a while at least, and one of the big questions is whether this is a stable monopoly or network effect or whether it's just going to be replaced by someone else's innovation 5 years from now. But at the moment, Amazon has pulled to itself a higher share of web commerce than people were expecting, and with the acquisition of Whole Foods, which is widely seen as being a camel's nose in the tent, not to sell the nation a whole lot of specialized and highly costly luxury goods of the sort associated with Whole Foods, but rather that this will be the way in which they learn grocery retail and that they will, within 5 or 10 years, figure out a way to serve the mass market, even if they start out with Whole Foods' prestige market.
Okay, so it's my understanding that when you're talking about antitrust, the first step of deciding whether or not a merger ought to go through is to define the relevant market.
Well, with mergers, you're talking about two different possibilities. One of them is so-called horizontal mergers in which Amazon will be picking up some other e-commerce competitor, someone who's trying to do the same thing as Amazon. And the other is so-called vertical mergers, and it's been noted that most of the huge technology successes, Google, Facebook, whatever, have not proceeded by horizontal mergers. Facebook did not buy up a bunch of would-be Facebooks. Instead, they grow by acquiring companies that allow them to provide a different kind of service. Facebook, for example, bought Instagram, and Instagram suddenly became much more important among several different competitive snapshot or picture-based social media things. Instagram did what it did better than Facebook's own efforts in that area. And likewise, it's not that Whole Foods and Amazon would be seen as major competitors to each other on a horizontal market analysis. It's much more like vertical. It's much more like Amazon took an area where it was something of a niche player, and people buy a few gourmet foods off Amazon, but it's they have a lot of other ways of buying them. But instead, getting a whole new distribution channel, which would allow it to serve people in completely new combinations of ways. When I was in a high-end grocery store recently, I discovered, this is probably old hat in California, but it was new hat to me in the Washington suburbs, that a lot of prime real estate at the front of the store was devoted to lockers for a system in which you order online. They gather the products and put them in bags and leave them in a chilled locker for you to pick up. Now, this is a new way of ordering groceries compared with either the all online, in which they deliver them to you, or the not online at all, in which you have to fill your basket by yourself, and yet was popular enough in this rather affluent Maryland neighborhood that they seem to be doing a lot of business or planning for a lot of business on it. And Amazon buying Whole Foods is widely expected to lead to some innovative new methods of distribution that we don't quite know yet, or not just because we are outsiders at Amazon, but because Amazon will itself discover new and better ways of doing things.
I hate to break it to you, but this is old hat in rural America as well. The idea of driving up and picking up your groceries is something that is steadily creeping up on us all over the country.
Okay.
So with respect to trying to the effort, which I think will be an effort to break up Amazon, where would you even begin?
Well, you know, libertarians have a long tradition of thinking about antitrust, and I'm answering your question in a roundabout way, but I do think it's important for us to point out that to the extent that antitrust lost its head of steam sometime around the 60s and 70s, libertarian and classical liberal scholars were very important in that happening. Some of them attacking the very basis of, you know, is this consistent with individual rights in an economy, but many of them pursuing economic analysis, consequentialist economic analysis of is this actually good for consumers, and finding that it mostly isn't good for consumers to have strong enforcement of antitrust laws. And with libertarian analysis, one of the insights that you always come back to is that most successful monopolies that endure, right, that are not just a temporary domination of a market, have some sort of bottleneck that the government has itself created. Where you lack that, the pressures of competition coming in, whether from abroad or from successful idea or a highly capitalized competitor, will tend to challenge someone's dominance. But when there is either a patent on the one hand or a access to utility permissions, as with the old AT&T, cable, electric and water utilities and the like, then you can have a durable sort of monopoly domination. Even things like gates at airports turn out to be more important than you would think in the concentration of the airline industry, because sometimes a competitive move to establish a new air carrier is made very difficult because of the unavailability of gates at certain key airports. So with Amazon, very interesting piece was out in the Wall Street Journal recently, and I don't have the technical knowledge to evaluate this, but it was about the Amazon's method of delivery for the last mile to the consumer, which is something like 2/3 of the deliveries are dropped off under a U.S. Postal Service program for high-volume shippers, in which they coordinate with the post office, drop it off close to the person's house. The post office handles the last mile. Now, officially, under federal law, the post office is supposed to recover all of its costs from package shippers. They don't want first-class senders and first-class mail receivers to be subsidizing that. And yet, as the article pointed out, allocating fixed costs over a system is, let's put it, an art. It is certainly not a science. It is something that assumptions and the formulas used to allocate the enormous fixed costs of all the salaries and all the real estate in the Postal Service, if you are using a formula, and the argument was, looked kind of plausible, that they were over-allocating to first class and under-allocating to package shippers, it all amounted, at least if you accepted this logic, to an enormous subsidy to the highest volume package shippers to American households, which means very disproportionately to Amazon, because when Amazon is competing against one of your other online sources, they will often not be a big enough mass shipper to take advantage of that particular program. So if that is true, then you might have a government subsidy combined with a bottleneck that has accelerated Amazon's domination. It would at least be one thing to look at if you're looking at non-antitrust ways of making sure that Amazon is open to full competition from people who would like to do the same thing.
And in a worst-case scenario, given whatever subsidy the Postal Service may be providing to high-volume shippers, you could build a business model around that subsidy.
You might very well be able to do so. And reforming the post office, of course, is something that the libertarians, again, have been at for decades, often a lonely job, challenging questions like the idea that rates must be geographically flat, even if it means that there is an implicit subsidy of living in extremely remote places that perhaps should not have been populated in some economic sense. But one of the things that libertarians have always recognized is that the post office, like antitrust law, is covertly used to subsidize and tax influential industries. And for a long time, publishing, which of course is now squawking about electronic competition, but publishing was itself one of the beneficiaries of post office subsidies and had a reason to keep the government happy over long periods, lest that be yanked away by some hostile administration. This brings us to one of the other problems with antitrust, one of the long-standing, enduring problems with antitrust, which is favoritism, and the way in which government uses it not to enforce some sort of objective rules about how competition is to be done, but rather to identify friendly and hostile businesses, businesses that have supported and businesses that have not supported campaigns, and to reward the one and punish the other. And you see this recently, of course, with President Trump having now twice brought up the possibility of a connection between hostile news coverage and antitrust actions, first during the campaign in which the hostile criticism of the Washington Post after it was bought by Jeff Bezos, even though that not actually owned by Amazon, it's close enough that Trump repeatedly said, Bezos is using the Post to attack me because he's worried about antitrust scrutiny of Amazon. And you can read that either as a sincere diagnosis of why he thought that the Washington Post, a newspaper that has been liberal for so long that, you know, to me it would have obviously have been critical of him before or after the Bezos purchase. Or you can read it as a veiled threat. You know, look, I can mess with you if you mess with me. The veiled threat theory became a little more even more credible recently when it was reported in a couple of different news outlets that after CNN had been giving Trump a lot of grief, he talked about White House staffers talked about whether or not the pending merger between Time Warner and AT&T, which is a pressure point for CNN because it's part of the Time Warner enterprise, whether it might be held up or denied unless they, in one account, unless they actually fired the head of CNN. This is not peculiarly American. One might wish that it never took place anywhere, but in it is a feature of systems with antitrust and a feature of systems with extensive government regulation of the business sector that this is exactly the kind of chit that the authorities love to call. They love to remind news organizations that things like antitrust can be held over them.
What are the political implications over the next few years? I've seen Break Up Amazon as a hashtag on Twitter, and I've seen some other more scholars saying, arguing basically, this is a monopoly and that the federal government needs to do something because the focus of companies like Amazon is almost purely on the consumer. That same is true of Walmart, and the concerns about producers and competitors of outsized producers like Walmart or Amazon when it comes to retail are not being taken into consideration.
Yeah. The pressure is certainly not coming mostly from consumers, because consumers tend to be thrilled at Amazon's policy of deliberately not charging as much as its costs might seem to be, so that it can keep expanding and building the network. The complaining is instead coming from a combination of competitors, especially brick-and-mortar competitors, to some extent probably online competitors too, but also suppliers, because the fear out there, and this was a fear of Walmart domination that is kind of being seamlessly transferred to fear of Amazon domination, is that if you are a producer of something consumers like, so much of their access to you gets funneled through this one particular thing, then you can be squeezed. You can be told, your wholesale price has just been cut by 30%, and we can enforce that because you can't possibly not distribute through us without giving up 80, 70, 90, whatever percent it is of your business. And so Amazon, in the fear, at least, Amazon will identify chances to squeeze its suppliers the same way that Walmart was so famous for squeezing its suppliers. And consumers may benefit for the indefinite future. Argument inevitably would be, well, Amazon at some point will get so powerful that it will then triple its prices and squeeze consumers. But for the time being, it is mostly the suppliers and the brick-and-mortar competitors who can see their profits shrinking when Amazon conquers the various things that it's doing well in.
Walter Olson is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and creator of OverLawyer.com. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.